Good evening, and welcome to our free teleseminar tonight. This is Sandra Brown with the Institute for Relational Harm Reduction. And tonight we are going to be doing part two of the super traits of personality. We began part one a week or so ago. I'm going to be getting that link and the link from tonight, and we'll post them in the Institute for Relational Harm Reduction Facebook page. And if you're an LRP, I will post it in the LRP Facebook group also in the next day or two, in case you want to listen to them again, especially if you missed part one, where we talked a great deal about the importance of understanding what part of your personality is often targeted. And so if you missed that, that's really important part of understanding the super traits of personality, so do listen to that. So before we get started tonight, in case we have any new listeners, just a word about the Institute, in case you don't know who we are. We are the Institute for Relational Harm Reduction. We are a trauma-informed care agency that is focused on pathology education and also recovery services for survivors of Cluster B and psychopathic relationships. You can find out more information at saferelationshipsmagazine.com. Okay, so tonight we're going to get started on the second super trait. I had hoped to do it all in one recording, like on the last recording, but since I am a prolific talker and I can't seem to make anything short, I talk too much, and so there wasn't enough time to do it. So so this is a really brief recap. We studied the super personality traits of what we were suspecting was being targeted in survivors. And the first trait that we talked about was the trait of agreeableness. And we called that the relationship investment trait. And both of these personality traits have a number of facets, which mean parts, that make up that trait. And we went over the facets or parts of agreeableness. And the agreeableness traits were what we called the relationship investment traits. It's what made you warm and open and empathetic and tolerant and loyal and trusting. All the kinds of traits in a personality that make a person very relationship oriented. And as we have talked about with these personality trait elevations, that these traits have not seemed to be a problem in normal relationships, not just intimate relationships, but friends, work situations, wherever there are normal people, these traits were likely not problematic. The only place that having too much of that trait of agreeableness and being too relationship invested that seemed to be problematic was in the hands of someone who had an antagonistic type personality. And so that trait of agreeableness as the relationship investment trait, the data shows, and what we believe is that that's sort of the trait that is targeted for the entering into the relationship. It's had a lot to do with even maybe your likelihood of not reading red flags up front, so that took quite a bit of time in order for that to be recognizable to you. And some of that, you know, has to do with that personality trait elevation. So agreeableness has a lot to do with the entry into the pathological relationship. And tonight we're going to talk about the second trait, which is the trait of conscientiousness, that is the trait responsible, likely responsible, for having difficulty disengaging from the relationship. We think that this is one of the traits that contributed to the longevity of the pathological relationship, because people who have smaller doses, if you will, smaller amounts of conscientiousness in their personality have far less tolerance for the behavior, and were much more inclined to leave the relationship earlier. So tonight we're going to talk a little bit about this trait of conscientiousness. And we had labeled agreeableness as the relationship investment trait. And conscientiousness we call the integrity-oriented trait, or the integrity-driven life trait. So, about in the last webinar, there are facets and parts that make up each one of these traits, and we're going to go over those. So hold one second while I find my page. Okay. Hold up. All right. So the interesting thing about this trait of conscientiousness is that the assessment tool that we use, which was the five-factor, studies each component or personality trait that makes up our personality. And we have only been talking about two of a multitude of traits that make up our personality. And that's because agreeableness and conscientiousness were the ones that were elevated in most survivors that were past the sweet spot on the bell curve that is sort of the safety net, kind of that mid-range where it's safest in some ways in personality, because there's not too little of anything or too much of anything. So you guys on the bell curve were like two steps over to the side in these two traits of agreeableness and conscientiousness, which just fell slightly into the high normal range. And so I don't know that we've really thought that much about what too much of a good thing can do. I mean, when you have too much trust, too much empathy, too much tolerance. And so the same thing is true about this trait of conscientiousness. And so when the five factor studies all the different traits that make up your personality, they study them individually for what they contribute and do within the personality structure. And the interesting thing about conscientiousness is that people who have high normal amounts in their personality of conscientiousness is used as a measurement for success. So having a high normal or high amount of conscientiousness, for instance, is what colleges look at in some of their testing for admission. It gives them a snapshot of the likelihood of success, of actually sticking with college all the way through. It's a good prediction of college graduation. In corporations, for big management jobs, they will often use personality assessments, and they look for candidates who test high normal or high in this trait of conscientiousness. Because just like the word implies, these are people who pay great amount of attention to the task in front of them. And so this trait of conscientiousness, again, is a good trait, only harmful in the hands of an antagonistic, disordered partner. So the facets or the parts that make up this trait of conscientiousness, the first one is efficient. That means you are competent, resourceful, and slightly perfectionistic. And so when we think about, you know, what that trait is likely to do in a pathological relationship as the relationship is becoming problematic, the mask has slipped, you've glimpsed the problems in the relationship, and in comes this trait of conscientiousness with all this competence and resourcefulness, that you don't have to pull up, you know, from your toenails, like pulling up your bootstraps. It's naturally flowing and in there. It's always been there, and it's probably made you a good organizer of people, good, resourceful. Friends probably come to you with their problems because you always have ideas about how to use resources in order to help someone. So not coming from necessarily from codependency, you're not trying to fix someone so that you feel better. You are naturally efficient to be resourceful to whatever problems are in front of you. So at work, this has probably made you very competent in your job or jobs, and very competent with other people. Like I said, other people that come to you because you are naturally efficient, competent, and resourceful. So as the relationship starts having problems, your inner resources, come up with a therapist for him, a 12-step group, other kinds of resources for whatever his problems are, rehab, whatever, job skills. So there's a lot of assumption that someone who would jump in and do that kind of, do those kinds of things, that it is automatically connected to this idea of codependency. And we're going to talk about that a little later if I have time. But that's not where in over 60-some percent of the survivors that we research and tested, that level of resourcefulness that was automatically jumping in and helping the relationship through your own resourcefulness, over 60-some percent of that was not connected to codependency. It was naturally occurring, hardwired into your personality. So that's a whole different approach. When your therapist just, automatically, just like in the agreeableness trait, when you have high normal amounts of trust, tolerance, empathy, loyalty, they automatically assume you're codependent and ship you off, to Codependence Anonymous, where for those of you who really don't have codependency, you got zero out of it. Well, the same thing happens with this trait of conscientiousness. So on the surface, if you're just looking at the external behavior of you being resourceful, there's going to be that assumption that it's being generated out of an issue of codependency, which is false. It's being generated out of a naturally occurring trait of conscientiousness. So the next facet is organized. And so I think it's really interesting because when we were looking at, what are the personality trait elevations, what is the whole personality of someone that could be for any extended period of time in a relationship with someone who has an antagonistic and chaotic personality. And we sort of suspected that you would have to be the total opposite of what a cluster B is. So so if the cluster B, the cluster Bs are called the dramatic and erratic, and so that's what they're all about. So we already suspected that you had to be, at least before the trauma, and the relationship much more of the cool, calm, and collected or organized kind of personality, because these guys are, you know, fall under the dramatic and erratic category. So with this facet or this part of organization is that you are probably, with the elevation and agreeableness, with all that tolerance and empathy, and now this trait of conscientiousness, the personality type most likely to be able to tolerate the disorganization of a cluster B personality. So you are naturally organized. And I'm not talking about the shape or condition of your house. That may not be the organization, but that you can organize chaotic environments. Maybe not now that you have trauma or cognitive dissonance, but before the onset of that, you had a naturally organized personality that could be in the presence of disorganization. And when we think about the cluster B's disorganization of thinking, feeling, relating, and behaving, that would so rattle other people that did not have a higher than normal dose of this trait of conscientiousness. And so, in a weird kind of way, this trait of conscientiousness worked against you, only, again, because it fell into the hands of an antagonistic partner. In the hands of normal people, high levels of conscientiousness would be a real blessing in the relationship. The next facet or part is dependable, that you are reliable, you take obligations and commitments seriously. And so, of course, they are banking on that, that you, in fact, do take your commitment to this relationship seriously. So you are not likely to cut and run when trouble starts in the relationship. And so this facet of taking your relationship seriously sort of, you know, matches up and is strengthened by those facets and agreeableness that are similar, that you are very relationship-oriented. And so you are naturally relationship-oriented, and now in conscientiousness on top of that, you also take those relationships seriously. And so conscientiousness, in some ways, at least in this setting, in an antagonistic personality, is what has kept you in the longevity of the relationship, or what we have called the gorilla glue or handcuffs of the relationship. The next facet or part is being very achievement-oriented. And so you're ambitious, efficient. You aim to fulfill outside expectations. You can be prone to setting lofty goals and expending great effort, often to the detriment of other pursuits. So we can see right there, you know, as one of those aspects, aiming to fulfill outside expectations, as the relationship, you know, continues on problematically, and the narcissist or psychopath keeps raising the bar so that you can never meet that goal. And you keep just naturally, not because you're codependent and you're trying to people please, but because you are hardwired to achieve. Remember I said conscientiousness is one of the things that the college looks at for guarantees of success? So here you are hardwired to be achievement-oriented and aiming to fulfill outside expectations that he will never allow you to fulfill. So he just keeps raising the bar and raising the bar. And what happens? This trait tells us what happens. You expend great effort, often to the detriment of other pursuits. So you're resourceful. You keep working at it. You keep looking for other solutions. And when it says, often to the detriment of other pursuits, you know, survivors say all the time, like, what happened to my life? I used to have all these interests and activities and friends. And yes, you know, narcissists and psychopaths tend to, you know, try to isolate you away from those kinds of things. But here you are naturally wired. You weren't giving those things up because of codependency. You were naturally hardwired to be achievement-oriented and to invest effort, often to the detriment of other things. And so that effort and that focus, with you being so relationship-invested and oriented, can be that great effort on the relationship. And so so that piece of just being naturally achievement-oriented can drive survivors in this conscientiousness trait about working harder than other people in the relationship who had less conscientiousness than they had. The next facet or part is self-disciplined, that you tend to be more controlled and not impulsive. And so this low impulsivity was definitely an issue in retaining you in the relationship, that you guys are less likely to give up and cut and run. Again, remember when we talked about conscientiousness was a good predictor of success, and that colleges look for that. They are looking for, you know, people that weren't impulsive, that when something got hard, they just quit. And so that's sort of the idea here, is that you were not prone to impulsivity. Now, you might be after some trauma has set in, but your original core personality was a person that stuck to it, and that they, you know, worked hard at whatever the problem or issue was. And then the last facet or part of conscientiousness is deliberateness. That means cautious, reflective, careful, persevering, and diligent. So let's take the first three. I'm going to separate those. Cautious, reflective, and careful. And so, of course, survivors are often perplexed how they ended up in a pathological relationship because they normally are cautious, reflective, careful, that you're not impulsive. You're not likely to meet a guy in a bar and end up in Vegas that night getting married and, you know, with an Elvis impersonator. That your natural personality is that you are careful, reflective, and cautious. And so how did this happen? And we know how it happened. So they wear the mask and they mirror and parrot and mimic and mirror back to you what looks like a mirror image of yourself, a cautious, reflective, and careful person. And so that's how they get in. So under this deliberate facet is also the descriptors about being persevering and diligent. And so, especially in the issue of persevering, that, again, another therapist may be seeing or hearing that perseverance in your storyline or in the relational dynamics might make a lot of assumptions about what that perseverance is in terms of dependency or codependency instead of it being not generated from people-pleasing but a naturally occurring element that you persevere in probably all areas of your life, at work, in other friendships, with your kids, with other challenges in your life, that you just are a perseverer naturally. And so, you know, the interesting thing about this trait of conscientiousness is that it is this trait and the higher element in the higher dosage of this at the high normal where you guys are in that in the high normal range there that conscientiousness at that level and higher is what is associated with great, innovative, social justice kind of leadership. So, for instance, people that had high normal or even higher than yours, high conscientiousness, were people like Nelson Mandela, Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr. And I, you know, I'm sure no one called them codependent, right? Of course, they, you know, we were seeing the presentation of their trait of conscientiousness in their, not in their intimate relationships. We were seeing it in their careers, in their social justice movements of this huge part of their personality that transformed the world. And it's just because, you know, the way that we end up seeing your conscientiousness is in the hands of an antagonistic partner, in the hands of a psychopath. And so we don't have that bigger perspective on your conscientiousness. We only have this snapshot of some relational dynamic that's happening that we have to make a decision about as we're hearing this. But this trait of conscientiousness is, you know, associated with successful people. This is what woke me up, that why, for instance, most of you don't fit sort of the traditional domestic violence survivor profile, even if you had domestic violence. This trait, this higher than normal trait of conscientiousness, is not associated with doormats. Would we ever have said, or passive people, or dependent people, we would have never said of Gandhi, Mandela, or King that these were passive people. That's what caught my attention, that this trait of conscientiousness is so, you know, associated with success and leadership, that I knew you guys had a whole different package in your personality than what we were accustomed to looking at in other types of victims. And so, so this trait of conscientiousness, in that word of conscientiousness, is the word conscience. So the interesting thing, as I began to continue to study this trait as it pertained to you guys, was the interesting thing about, for instance, cognitive dissonance, which is the number one symptom of all survivors, is that some of the cognitive dissonance research actually said that people that had higher levels of conscience or conscientiousness were more prone to developing cognitive dissonance than people who had less conscience and less conscientiousness. So we can see why cognitive dissonance is the number one symptom. You guys are already in the high normal category of a trait that has been identified with more cognitive dissonance because of that trait. And so this trait of conscientiousness has a whole lot to do with why you have more cognitive dissonance than maybe a survivor who had a bad breakup and had less of this trait of conscientiousness, who might spend a couple weeks really having intrusive thoughts about the breakup, but in a couple weeks it subsides. But with people with this high normal trait of conscientiousness, your cognitive dissonance does not resolve like that or reduce that quickly. And part of it is sort of this double-edged sword with this trait of conscientiousness. On one hand, it has made you the strong person and the leadership qualities that you do have. On the other hand, it has contributed to the development of pretty severe cognitive dissonance. So I'm going to get a little bit off track here with this, because we've already started talking about cognitive dissonance, and I'm just going to keep discussing that for a minute. So you're more prone to cognitive dissonance because of this trait of conscientiousness, and also just because of the nature of a personality disorder person who has two very different sides, the Jekyll and the Hyde, the love bombing and charming, and the sadistic and abusive side. And so you've had to process in your head two different relationships that are very different, and you had to have two different skill sets for whichever side of him walked through the door. So naturally, you're holding very different thoughts and feelings about both sides of him, loving, loathing, trusting, distrusting, craving, repulsion, wanting, not wanting. And that's cognitive dissonance. So, by the nature of being in a relationship with somebody who has two sides, and by having this high normal amount of conscientiousness, you are kind of a sitting duck for developing this very debilitating thinking process of cognitive dissonance, which is like a stuck pattern in the brain that compares and contrasts. Is he good? Is he bad? He did this today, but he did that yesterday. And so it's like a loop in the brain that gets stuck. But the interesting thing about this issue about conscientiousness and about its connection to cognitive dissonance is that these traits of conscientiousness, which I call the integrity-oriented trait or the integrity-driven life traits, are very much based on core values and beliefs and values and ethics and principles. So when we think about how high normal conscientiousness, like I said, that was associated with revolutionary leadership and Mandela and Gandhi and King, is that they were very much driven by and died from those strong core values and beliefs and principles and ethics. And so when you have high normal conscientiousness, this is important to know about yourself with this trait, that you are naturally hardwired to lead with those values and belief systems. And so cognitive dissonance, especially with you guys, and especially because you have high normal conscientiousness, is created not just when he is out here saying one thing and doing another. It's when you violate your own value and belief system because you are so hardwired to be, for your walk to match your talk, for your walk to match your belief system. And there's not a pathological love relationship alive that has ever existed where a survivor at some point in the relationship didn't have to sell out on their own values and belief systems. What was always, that always guided their beliefs and their behavior in life was based on whatever those core principles are, which, you know, are sort of standard core principles: honesty, integrity, monogamy. And so, you know, as the mask slipped and as you violated your belief in monogamy, as you violated your belief in that a person needs to be trustworthy, as you violated the belief that integrity matters, that's when cognitive dissonance really explodes, especially for you guys, especially for people that have high normal conscientiousness. You tend to hold yourself to a standard of excellent behavior. And, you know, as things change, as the dynamics changed in the relationship and you were having to tolerate things you did not believe in, the worst part of cognitive dissonance for survivors emanates out of this conscientiousness trait when they say, who have I become? Where is this belief system? I don't even recognize myself or my choices or my behaviors or what I have tolerated. And so the worst part of cognitive dissonance isn't just about him or isn't just about what he's done or the relationship. It's a cognitive dissonance with yourself that you have not stayed true to those core values and beliefs that are so important with people who have high normal conscientiousness. And so I think wisdom in this whole thing about understanding these your super traits is the wisdom in understanding how you are wired, because you can't protect what you don't understand. You can't rein in or supervise your super traits and what they're wanting to jump out there and do, especially in the agreeableness of just trusting and tolerating and being empathetic. But it's also true about conscientiousness that you can't adequately prevent future cognitive dissonance, not just in an intimate relationship, but at work, with friends, if you don't understand how important those issues of integrity are to someone who has high normal conscientiousness. So, when we think about this issue about conscientiousness and cognitive dissonance, and I often hear other writers talk about, like, the issue of the trauma bond and the reason why people get stuck in these relationships, that they have to break the trauma bond. No, you have to break the cognitive dissonance. That is what's holding it there. And you will always have more cognitive dissonance resulting from the makeup and breakup cycles. You will have more cognitive dissonance because of your high normal conscientiousness when you make up. And that even though the trauma bond, you know, creates that feeling of craving and longing for the relationship, you will have, as uncomfortable as that craving and longing is, it is less painful than the cognitive dissonance that you experience when you break from those values and belief systems and make up and go back into the relationship. That's when cognitive dissonance explodes. And so wisdom, the whole reason about studying these traits is for you to understand how you're wired and how integrity and value systems is so important for reducing and staying out of cognitive dissonance. And so especially for people who have high normal conscientiousness and who is struggling with cognitive dissonance, you have to lead with your integrity-oriented behavior. And so you have the issue of leading with behavior always steering your choices and your life from that high normal trait of conscientiousness. Anytime you are choosing from a place of integrity, you are not going to go wrong. And knowing that it is the violation of that has caused so much cognitive dissonance and pain. So I did an interview this week, a radio interview. They were actually wanting to talk about my other book, How to Spot a Dangerous Man. And, you know, she wanted to talk about, if you haven't read that book, it's 8 categories of dangerous man types, and then there's behaviors, how to spot behaviors associated with that. She wanted to go over these lists of all these behaviors, and that if we just learn these lists, that's what was going to help us spot and keep us safe, and we'll automatically see it coming, and we'll never end up in another pathological relationship. Well, I wrote that book in, I think, 2005. If I was writing that book today, knowing what I know, that you guys already come hardwired with this high normal conscientiousness, and that you are prone to cognitive dissonance when you violate your own integrity, I would write that book very different today. I would write how to spot based on the creation of cognitive dissonance. That cognitive dissonance is the red flag, especially in you guys. we don't need to learn less and less of behaviors. We need to know what cognitive dissonance feels like. And when we're having it, we're already not steering from the thing that we're wired to steer from, which is core values, beliefs, principles, and ethics. And so that can be one of the things that you pay great attention to in your recovery, and what cognitive dissonance feels like when you're starting to have it. And because of this conscientiousness trait, you are leaning towards choosing outside of values and beliefs. Somebody is asking you or implying, or the relationship feels like it's leaning towards things that are not congruent with someone with high normal conscientiousness. So, so that's the two trait elevations, agreeableness and conscientiousness. I think we are not going to have time to jump into and compare and contrast super traits with codependency, but I think we should do another one more teleseminar. See, I told you I talk too much. One more teleseminar now that we've really broken down the super traits, and then we're going to compare them to the traits of codependency. And you see for yourself if you're codependent or if you're super traited, or if you have a little of both, which I haven't seen a whole lot of people have that, but we'll see. So, I am going to, hold on, I have to find my list. We have a couple of minutes, and I'm going to unmute this so that if people have questions. So hold on one sec. I'm looking for unmute. All right. I don't know if I unmuted you. I don't hear anybody, so might not have. Let me try it again. Hold on. Okay.
Is that unmuted?
You should be unmuted. Okay. All right. Do we have any questions about what we went over tonight?
Well, Sandra, this is Kathy. I will just say I am not a doormat, and you explained that very well. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've never been a doormat.
No. But that's usually the assumption when they hear the relational dynamics, unfortunately.
Right.
Yeah. They don't have any other way, because we've never studied personality.
But I will say I became peculiarly passive in the face of a narcissist. That is something that did happen to me. I was much more passive and compliant there than I normally am.
Sandra, I don't know. Hello? Hello? Hi.
I think Sandra isn't there. I don't know. I don't hear her.
He might have gotten muted.
Okay.
Oh.
I leaned on my phone.
I had a quick question. This is Sage.
Okay.
I thought it was so interesting how you talked about organization, and being that I came from a family of a lot of chaos in my childhood, I'm
mm-hmm.
always able to make organization out of that on some level,
yep.
even though there
mm-hmm.
are some aces there. But it's
yep.
I'm comfortable in that situation, so I don't know. Again, I'm kind of feel like I need to differentiate. Like, I don't know if that's from my family of origin trait.
Right, right.
Or if it's just the way that I am. But I'm not organized necessarily in keeping the cleanest house.
Right.
So I
and
appreciated
it's
that.
It's not about that, yeah. Right,
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we're gonna talk about... we're going to have to come back to do the comparing of super traits with codependency, and we'll talk about family of origin issues and how
okay.
those overlap. Yeah, because some people do have those. And we're going to look at the difference between external behaviors and codependency and internal personality representation, like that thing about organized. So the organization, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank
mm-hmm.
you. Sure. Any other questions?
Now, it's such a relief to hear these things.
Yeah. I'm glad. Yes, I it made sense. That's what survivors say, is that it fits, you know, much more to their experience of themselves than the labels of, you know, codependency and things like that. So I agree.
Well, thank you.
Thank you,
Sandra.
Thank you.
Sandra.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap this.
I have one more
yes?
question. Do you think if
okay.
you were raised in a religious family, that might have something to do with it?
Personality is innate.
Okay.
What you're talking. Yes. So. They didn't have anything to do with your personality, but they had a whole lot of control on your external behavior and probably
okay.
your thinking. But this is about just coming into the world, you know,
mm-hmm.
Just like introversion or extroversion. We don't change those in ourselves. They're not... they're just there. And that's what we're talking about with personality. Next time, we'll talk about external factors like
okay.
family of origin issues and compare and contrast those. So I will
Thank
post
you.
Something both in LRP Facebook and also the Institute Facebook group when the next one, when we reschedule the next one. So thank you for joining me tonight.
Yeah.
This has been Sandra Brown with the Institute. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night, Sandra. Okay.